And from the studios at KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. My co-host Lynn Ware Peake is under the weather this morning, and we wish her a very speedy recovery. NASA, they have facilities all over the world. Each one is chock full of very bright and talented people, but there's something special going on in Pasadena. JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, has been knocking out history's most jaw-dropping feats of engineering since the 1960s. The list would take, well, take a long time to go through, so I'll just throw a couple out. All 10 Mariner spacecraft starting in 1962 came from JPL. Juno, another spacecraft, is one of the more recent, entered the orbit of Jupiter in 2016. The Kepler Space Telescope identified 4,500 and counting. There's going to be a bunch more exoplanets. Remember our show with Adam Stelzner? Well, his team at JPL safely landed the Curiosity, a 2,000-pound, $2.5 billion rover on the surface of Mars, a mere 140 million miles away. Our next guest, Dr. Andrew Shapiro, is the manager of early stage innovation for the Space Technology Office at JPL. We'll be talking with him about some current projects and also about what it's like managing a lab where ideas become concepts, concepts, projects, and eventually maybe even a part of a mission for robotic and manned space exploration. Our second guest this morning, Bill Andrews, who's the senior associate editor for Discover Magazine. We'll talk with Bill about what's new in the world of artificial intelligence. Current thinking is we are safe from Star Trek's Borg for now, but exciting and human-friendly machine learning continues to push forward. We'll also talk with Bill about exoplanets, you know, those planets and star systems outside of our own. And we look forward to our conversation with him. These two guests plus today's cool stories when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Angela from Peak Art and Frame, longtime supporters of KPCW. Peak Art and Frame offers custom picture framing, rush options, hanging and delivery services, and in-house designers. Open Monday through Saturday, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Our first guest this morning, Dr. Andrew Shapiro, is currently the manager of early stage innovation for the Space Technology Office at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, part of Caltech in Pasadena, California. He also manages the NASA Innovative Advanced Concepts, the NASA Center Innovations Funds, and the NASA Strategic Technology Research Fellowships for JPL. He previously spent 7 years as chief technologist for the Enterprise Engineering Division, and he's been working in technology and microelectronic interconnects for more than 30 years. Dr. Shapiro, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Dr. Shapiro, one of your responsibilities at JPL is to manage the acronym NAIC, NASA Innovative Advanced Concepts. Can you tell us about this group?
Yes, the NASA Innovative Advanced Concepts is a very interesting program that's developed by NASA headquarters. It's the rebirth of a program that existed more than a decade ago, and it was regenerated in 2011. Since 2011, it's been encouraging visionary ideas that can transform future NASA missions with creative breakthroughs to give radically new mission concepts. It seeks innovation from diverse and non-traditional sources. It's open to anybody in the country, all kinds of institutions, even private individuals if they meet certain qualifications. And people can submit these. It's a call that comes out every year, and JPL submits its proposals to compete with everybody else's, and we've been doing pretty well so far.
Yeah, last week NASA announced support of 22 visionary exploration concepts, and of the 22, JPL received the go-ahead for 5 of the 22. That's pretty impressive.
Thank you. We have very sharp people who work very hard.
Dr. Shapiro, I've managed people all my life in the tech business, and on the engineering side, when you have really bright engineers, you want to give them some room. You want them to be, you know, they're, you know, everybody's different on the management side, but I'm curious about how you encourage ideas to become concepts and maybe to propose something in the conceptual stage for one of these programs, and then how that would move towards a program. How does all that happen? How do you encourage ideas to become concepts?
Well, it's an interesting process. At JPL, we have, as you pointed out, a large number of very creative individuals. The difficulty isn't getting concepts. Everybody has wonderful ideas here. One of my managers a few years ago just put out a call saying we're interested in innovative concepts just to the prior to the release of this program. And he got over 750 concepts in a week. So a lot of people have really great ideas. The difficulty and the real challenge is in getting those great ideas to become practical. And some of them are just too difficult to really get to the point where we can make them into a mission. Other ones have the ability to be moved along into to be formed into something that could actually become a future mission. And NIAC is actually a great venue that NASA provides for us to do that. The way that we do it is NASA puts out a call, a solicitation, in August typically of each year, asking for new ideas. What I do at the laboratory here is I pass the call along to all the technical individuals. Many apply. I typically have about 30 people who show interest in this kind of concept. I encourage them. I have a kickoff meeting and encourage everybody who applies to kind of get their concept down. There's a very short pre-proposal format that they use, a 3-page concept generation idea. And then I review each concept with each of the potential principal investigators. We call them PIs. As we work with each of the PIs to develop their concepts, we challenge them in terms of the way that a reviewer might challenge each concept. Is it really practical? Does the physics work? Have you made any kinds of errors? Has this been done someplace else before? And then we look at the filtering of these concepts as they start to pass these gates. And some of them are just not ready yet. Some of them are quite excellent, or some of them, somebody tried that 20 years ago and didn't succeed for one reason or another. And on those, sometimes it's time to try it again because technology has evolved. Other times, well, there was a good reason that it didn't work and somebody's already explored that.
So you mentor them. You actually work with them through the process. And I believe that there's a phase one and a phase two. Phase one is the earlier side, and phase two comes from phase one if they believe that additional funding is required. Is that correct?
That's entirely correct. So the way that it works is the phase one and phase two calls come up at the same time. But the requirement to get a phase two is to have had a successful phase one. So we developed the phase one proposals, which are typically about $125,000 and 9 months in duration. And they're typically paper studies where somebody has kind of thought of a good idea, done some preliminary physics calculations that say, yeah, this idea might work. And then they've had a chance, they've had 9 months to work on that. $125,000 at burden rates and that kind of thing doesn't go very far, so they don't spend full time on this. This is kind of a side job for them. They like to do it because they're really interested. And they develop that concept, and they end up writing a final report. And sometimes the final report just says, you know, this concept was really interesting, but we did the details and looked at all the possibilities, and it's just not going to work. Sometimes the idea really does look like it has a promising future, and say this could really work if we studied it some more. So then they apply for a phase two. And when they fly for a phase two, that's a two-year study, usually about $500,000. Usually it involves a team with industry and universities and maybe other NASA centers really looking at a problem in much more depth. And if we're successful in a phase two, it'll be a precursor eventually to a mission that we might eventually do at JPL.
Okay. And are there people that are batting 1,000 every time that they pitch something like this? They seem to get the nod to go forward. Do you have people that have continually pitched ideas and have not been picked up yet? Is that a difficult thing to manage?
Yes. We have. I don't think anybody's batted 1,000, but we've had people who've done pretty darn well. And typically, people propose ideas. They get comments back from the reviewers at NASA, and the comments help us reshape the proposal. And often they'll propose it the second year and do much better. So we have a lot of people who didn't go in the first time. So the way that we generally do, we get something like 30 concepts in the what they call step A of phase one, which is just it's essentially something we call a quad chart that describes the concept in a view graph, and I think most of those are available publicly.
Right.
And then once they've gotten past step one, we go from 30 to about a dozen that are invited to write full proposals. So out of those dozen, this time in the phase one, we had 3 win. And that's a pretty good track record from our perspective. But there are a lot of disappointed people, right? Obviously, we have people who had very good ideas that were really worthwhile, but just didn't get funded for various reasons. Sometimes it's not as high a priority with NASA. Sometimes NASA has particular interests that it expresses through the decadal surveys done by the National Academy. NASA also has a specific strategic plan in terms of the technologies they want to develop. And the question is, how closely are these aligned with these long-range plans?
Right. Okay. We've been doing Cool Science Radio for about 3.5 years, and one of the themes that we have observed continually is the amount of collaboration that's going on today versus just a while back when people were individual islands of work, and not only within the discipline of engineering, but, you know, with pulling in biology and the arts and everything else. Do you have a lot of collaboration that goes into a phase one bid?
Absolutely. I would say virtually all of our proposals have some kind of collaboration or another involved. Sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's not obvious. The NIAC call, it comes out of a portion of NASA called the Space Technology Mission Directorate, and my office is a counterpart at JPL to that directorate. And that directorate has strongly encouraged collaboration with the outside. Great examples, for instance, are the NASA Space Technology Research Fellowships, which I also manage for JPL. That's part of a larger NASA program in which we engage graduate students from typically 80 universities across the country, and we work with them to develop university concepts that are relevant to NASA that we can bring into NASA. So we do a tremendous amount of work with universities. We also like to involve industry through the SBIR program. NASA has a very strong SBIR program in which we encourage small companies to develop concepts that are of interest to NASA, technologies that are of interest to NASA, and we try to incorporate as many of these as we can. As we get the government to spend money on things that are of interest, we try to pick things that will benefit us for future missions.
Okay. All right. One that grabbed my attention, actually there were a number that grabbed my attention, a breakthrough propulsion architecture for interstellar precursor missions. I'm not even sure what that is.
That's by a brilliant engineer here at the lab named John Brophy. Mm-hmm. John is responsible. I don't know if you're aware of a mission that's just maybe been canceled by the president's budget. We're not sure yet, but there was an asteroid retrieval mission.
Yes.
Which was actually completely the idea of John Brophy, the author of this particular proposal. This proposal is an interesting one in its trying to get a spacecraft out to a place called the Oort cloud. The Oort cloud is about 60 AU from the Earth. I'm sorry, 600 AU from the Earth, which is quite a ways.
AU,
and what this is, AU is the astronomical unit, which is the distance from the Earth to the Sun.
Okay.
And so think about that, 600 times
93.
The distance from the Earth to the Sun.
Yeah.
That's quite a ways out there. And what this is this is he's trying to develop a propulsion system using solar electric propulsion that'll get us all the way out to the Oort cloud. And the Oort cloud is kind of the first step towards an interstellar mission. So keep in mind that the closest star is 268,000 AU away from the Earth.
Right.
So 600 is just kind of first baby step in going that direction. And the question is, why would you want to go out to the Oort cloud? And that relates to one of the other proposals that were that won this last round by a gentleman named Slava Turgiev. And Slava's proposal was to put a telescope out at the Oort cloud. And the question is, why would you put a telescope out at the Oort cloud? What's interesting about that? What Slava proposed was to use the sun as a lens. And the way that works is that the gravitational field of the sun will actually focus the photons from objects that are at the focal point at the opposite side. And it turns out that the focal point for a lens the size of the sun is about 600 AU from the Earth.
Ah,
and so
there you go.
Put a telescope out at the Oort cloud about 600 AU, they could image something about 600 AU on the other side of the sun. Now, it turns out that that's where the other focal point, but they could actually, anything in that path and going well beyond that, they could image. And in fact, they could image stars that are in the direct opposition to the sun from this telescope out at 600 AU. And at quite a few light years beyond that. So his calculations, and if they're correct, it will be an amazing thing. His calculations say that he could get something like 10-kilometer resolution on an exoplanet at the opposite side of the sun from where the telescope is.
And the name of the game now, since we've identified, and correct me if I'm wrong, since we've identified so many exoplanets, is now to try to understand what the biology of these planets is. And this type of technology would allow us to do that, wouldn't it?
That is exactly correct. The question is, of course, that everybody wants to know, is there life other places? Is there life other places in the solar system? And certainly, is there life in other places beyond the solar system? With something like 10 to the 24th stars, and pretty much every one of them having a planetary system of some kind, we think there's a very high probability that there's going to be life of some kind, not necessarily something that looks like our life, but some kind of life on some other planet.
Right. Communication, space communication right now is relatively slow. I understand that that they're working on some sort of laser communication. How long would it take to be able to get images from 600 AU away?
That's a good question. That's about, I haven't done that calculation.
But it could be a lifetime.
No. From 600 AU, it would be weeks, I'm guessing.
Oh, weeks, okay.
On that order, let me think.
All right.
It takes us about 2 days to get something back from Voyager.
Right.
So keep going past that about 100 times, maybe.
Yeah.
So,
Dr. Shapiro, pick another project, either in Phase 1 or Phase 2, that you'd like to talk about.
Well, they're all very interesting. I think one of the ones that might be of particular interest is this one by a young gentleman named Jonathan Satter. And Jonathan's project is something called an automaton rover for extreme environments. And what that addresses is the difficulty of landing a mission on Venus. Venus is really, really tough environment. It's about 500 degrees C on the surface. It has a sulfuric acid atmosphere, and it's at about 90 bars. Keep in mind, we're at 3/4 of a bar here in an Earth atmosphere.
Right.
And so 90 bars is like being underwater quite a ways.
Right.
So the question is, what do we do there? I believe the Russians have the record, and it's maybe a day or two on the surface of Venus of operations, and then their spacecraft die because of these extremely harsh conditions. Mm-hmm. Electronics that we make today typically won't survive those conditions. So we've been looking at this problem in detail at JPL for a number of years, but Jonathan took a completely different approach. What he did is he created a rover concept that is based essentially entirely mechanically. So he minimized, or he tried to eliminate, I don't know if he'll actually succeed, but he tried to eliminate all electronics, all the kinds of things that would fail, and essentially modeled a rover after the automatons of the late 1800s, where there were these incredibly complex mechanical machines that could do all kinds of different things. And in fact, we had mechanical calculators at that time that could do amazing things. And what he was able to do was design a rover that could sample the atmosphere, take care of things, walk around the surface of Venus in this extreme environment, all mechanically. There are a couple of things that would have to happen with that. For instance, if he got samples, they would maybe have to be returned to an orbiting ship. Not quite sure how that works in the concept. And also maybe some communications. He had a concept for even mechanical sound wave communications. Not sure how pragmatic that is, but the truth is very small electronics. For instance, we've developed a transmitter here that will work at 500 degrees centigrade. If we just use that one little bit of electronics and we're able to send scientific data back to an orbiting ship, then we could do a tremendous amount of work, and it would last a long time. Instead of a few hours, we could imagine this rover walking around for weeks or months.
Wow. Well, I mentioned earlier in the introduction that there are some very talented engineers throughout NASA, throughout the world. What is it about JPL that makes it such a standout engineering center?
That's a difficult question to answer.
I mean, you have sort of a reputation as tackling really tough problems and coming up with very innovative solutions. Is it the Caltech side? Is it the JPL side? Is it what is it?
It's really difficult. I think one of them is that we have a certain synergy of getting a lot of really bright people that are interested in a particular topic, concentrated in one small area. Definitely the presence of Caltech helps. A number of people have joint appointments with Caltech, and we do a tremendous amount of collaboration with Caltech for various concepts. I think the idea of getting these smart people, and these people are really dedicated and interested in space issues, space science, space technology, space engineering. They're not here for the money. These people are really dedicated folks who want to make a difference, want to do space exploration, are really devoted to this kind of problem solving. It's what's fascinated them typically for their entire lives. And so you get a concentration of those people in one spot, and then you give them the freedom to do and work on what they think is interesting. You have to corral them a little bit. But the best thing to do, as you pointed out earlier, is to kind of get out of their way and let them do fantastic things by giving them just a little bit of guidance and some boundaries.
And that's where you come in, because you can be a mentor. You can give one team a little bit more room. You can manage tightly maybe another project. I mean, so you can make those decisions yourself as a manager, right?
I do, but the truth is I get a lot of help. I think the real skill is to find people who can help in the right areas. We have people who are extremely deep scientifically but are not as creative maybe. We have other folks very creative but not as deep scientifically. And part of my job is to kind of make matches of these different kinds of people and also get the right kind of people to review the proposals. I have a team that looks at these things and helps edit them and ask the tough questions, and getting reviewers that have the right technical abilities. They aren't necessarily experts in any of these particular fields, but they have the ability to look at an overall concept and look for the holes in it, and that's something we do quite a bit at JPL. We try to find all of the holes, and because that's the way we think here. It's a cultural issue in terms of if you didn't think of something that could go wrong, there's a chance your multi-billion dollar mission will fail. So we spend a tremendous amount of time trying to think of everything that could possibly go wrong and try to make sure we've got that addressed in one way or another. And we do this on a very small scale for the proposals. We try to think of the different ways a reviewer could look at it, the different ways people might say, yeah, this concept doesn't make sense, and we try to address those issues.
Yeah, and I know I'm going to probably misstate this one, but I remember in a conversation that I had with Adam Stelzner about Curiosity entering the Mars atmosphere, right before it did, they figured out that maybe some of the math was wrong, and they had to go back and recalculate some things. I mean, this is all done real time, and it could be 140 million miles away while you're doing it.
Yes, we do have particular times where there's a great deal of pressure. We take a tremendous amount of pain to make sure that we have things lined up, look at the calculations, and have done as much homework as we possibly could think of beforehand. So if something like that comes up, we're in a position that we can do the recalculation quickly and see if it still matches up with what we're seeing in terms of the telemetry data.
Right. Well, couple of other things I wanted to mention, that this phase one, phase two, that the people that are awarded, it's all based on peer reviewed. So it's all of you amongst yourselves and all the NASA facilities that are actually reviewing these proposals. Is that correct?
That's correct. So NASA has a peer review concept, and they typically, for instance, they have a conflict of interest system set up so that somebody from JPL is not reviewing another JPL proposal. But we do provide reviews for other NASA centers and outside proposals because we have experts in these different space technologies areas. I serve as a reviewer for some proposals. Other people, experts in different areas in the lab, serve as reviewers for other kinds of proposals.
Right.
At the end of the day, there are teams that review all the proposals, give them grades, and then there's the NIAC board of directors that I think actually does the ultimate selection. And the board of directors has been really, really interesting. It has some extremely famous people on it. Mm-hmm. I don't know the current composition, but people who formerly were on it were people like Buzz Aldrin.
Yeah.
Dr. Drake of the famous Drake's Equation, which was the calculation for the probability of life on another planet. He was on the board. These are fascinating people, and we have a symposium each year, which I go to with the winners of the different awards, and we get a chance to talk with these folks, and it's just an amazing experience.
Dr. Shapiro, you can't do the jobs or have the responsibilities that you have, and I also understand you hold yourself 12 patents and you have 8 additional patent applications. You can't do that without being a very curious person. Over the years, what has surprised you most that you've learned about technology or NASA or the teams that you work with? What has surprised you most?
I think the thing that's surprising is the huge pool of talent that we have here. As I'd mentioned earlier, when we made that call, and we just in a week had 750 just really outstanding novel ideas. So the amount of creativity that's around in the laboratory is unbelievable. That just shocked me.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time, but very much enjoyed this conversation. We'd love to have you back on sometime.
Oh, I'd love to come back. Thank you so much.
Great. Dr. Andrew Shapiro, Manager of the Early Stage Innovation for Space Technology Office at JPL, and a whole bunch more. Thank you, sir. When we return, we're going to have a conversation with Bill Andrews, Senior Associate Editor for Discover Magazine. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
This is Courtney Johansson with the Spur Bar and Grill, and we are proud to support KPCW. With our new 352 Main Street entrance, the Spur now features three bars serving breakfast, lunch, dinner, drinks, and dancing. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. with live music every night. More information at thespurbarandgrill.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We were just speaking with Dr. Andrew Shapiro, Manager of Early Stage Innovation for the Space Technology Office at JPL. Our next guest, Bill Andrews, is a regular contributor to Cool Science Radio and Senior Associate Editor for Discover Magazine. You know, the board game Go has an incredibly high number of board combinations. The number 2 followed by 170 zeros. That's a very big number. Well, last year, Google's artificial intelligence machine handily beat the world's number 1 human 4-1. We're going to talk to Bill about the fascinating world of artificial intelligence. We're also going to talk with him about exoplanets, you know, planets that reside in star systems outside our own, and what our space telescopes are learning about these extraordinary planets. Articles on artificial intelligence and exoplanets appear in Discover's April 2017 issue. Bill Andrews, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here. So I've been, of course, looking at every one of your issues. Last time we spoke was when you had the 100 top science stories of the previous year. And you guys have been pretty busy. You've been knocking out some pretty good issues.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, it's always tempting after one of the double issues to take a little bit of a break and be like, okay, now we can take the next month off, right? But
yeah. No,
it's only ever just catching up at that point. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about a couple of these articles, and maybe we can start with artificial intelligence. Before I ask you to describe the article and we can talk about it, I just want to mention one thing that really grabbed my attention. There's this AI2 company that provides designs and builds artificial intelligence systems. And the one thing, you know, there's so many people that are focused on making money. And there's a quote from Oren Etzioni. I hope I pronounced his name correctly. Mm-hmm. He's the CEO. And he says that the mandate is simple. Confront the grandest challenges in artificial intelligence research and serve the common good. Profits be damned. That's refreshing.
Yeah, it isn't every day you hear a CEO talk that way. But
yeah.
I mean, that's how these guys operate. They're really just interested in solving the challenges, and not just, you know, because it's fun to be able to figure out puzzles and be able to make these things work, but the potential for being able to help out humanity is really great. And anything that can improve AI, artificial intelligence, and make it really actually intelligent is going to be super helpful. So yeah, they're helping make it come along.
Yeah, the one thing we need to put on the table right away is that current thinking is that Star Trek Cyberborg will not be taking over soon. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah, that's one of the writer of the story is my colleague Carl Engelking, and I was the editor of the story, and so we now joke around the office anytime there's any hint of a AI taking over or a Terminator-style future or anything where the robots are against us, we both just kind of give each other a knowing look. And now hopefully we can share that look with all the readers of the story, because it's not like that. We're not anywhere close to that. AI can do specific things really, really well, like the game of Go that you mentioned. That's a very difficult, specific task that a computer was able to master and beat humans at. And so a lot of people took that and were like, oh, no, what's next? They're going to beat us at everything. But it's not like that one computer program that can play Go is going to go out and knows anything about anything else. It can't cross the street. It can't doesn't know a cat from a dog necessarily. It can't even play chess. You know, it's just very specific intelligence. So
yeah,
that's the next frontier, is being able to get computers and computer intelligence to actually have broad knowledge and be able to apply their specific intelligence to general concepts.
And a lot of things we take for granted as humans, being able to, you know, understand what you're looking at, for an example. One of the things in the book, I love the writer's and your sense of humor. A Roomba teaches itself the layout of your living room. A Roomba, you know, the thing, you know, the robotic vacuum cleaner. A Roomba teaches itself the layout of your living room, but it will run over dog poop on the rug and turn the house into a fecal Jackson Pollock painting. First of all, I appreciate that sense of humor.
Yeah, that was a fun. We weren't sure we were going to get away with that when the higher up saw those lines, but we were like, let's try it. Let's push the envelope a little bit.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And that's I mean, that really conveys the point. It's a smart machine. It knows how to map your living room and how to cover every square inch and be able to vacuum it. But if there's something out of its area of expertise, if there is that little bit of dog poop that gets in the way, it's not going to know. It's not going to be able to do anything about it, and it'll just smear away.
Yeah, and it's easy for you and I to sit back and say, well, you know, we're not at, you know, the cyberborg or not knocking on the door. These things are very specific. There's no one machine that does, there's a lot of work to be done. But there, truth be known, there are people in this country and around the world whose jobs have been displaced by technology. And so it's difficult for them. And so besides talking about technology, there's this whole other thing that I hope that our country starts really spending some time looking at, and that's how do we retrain? How do we redistribute? How do we help the people that are going to be displaced? Because the freight train has left the station, and you're not going to stop technology. You're not going to legislate it, I can tell you that, I don't think you are. So that's another thing that needs to be considered, right?
Right. That was kind of the main balance we were trying to keep in the story between the optimism of Ornazioni and his prophets be damned, and we're trying to help the common good and improve, you know, lives here. But at the same time, while the robot apocalypse isn't going to happen anytime soon, it does look like there could be a lot of pain as machines and robots do get better at their specific tasks and push people out of the workplace. So it isn't totally bleak. It doesn't mean that no one's going to have a job in the future, but it is something that we have to look at. And there was one quote in the story about, hopefully we'll just be able to keep incorporating AI into human jobs. They still need humans behind them. Somebody's got to program these AIs. Somebody's got to know which data to feed them and how that's all going to work. And so there's still going to be a place for humans somewhere. And hopefully we'll just be able to find the room for everybody to still have something to do, be able to contribute meaningfully, and not just sit around idle if the robot took over their job.
We did a cool science story, you know, these little short little vignettes a couple years ago on something that I picked up in the New York Times. It was about these Italian judges. They're parole judges, and they listen to parole cases. And they looked at what they were doing, and they found that in the morning they were pretty good about granting people parole. But as the morning wore on and they started to get hungry for lunch, they started denying parole left and right. And then about 3 o'clock in the afternoon when they needed a snack or a nap, they started denying parole, denying these parole applications. And this particular group has been replaced by a computer. And they say that the efficiency of the parole application process has gone from like 50 or 55% to more like 90%. So there are some good things that are happening, especially when you're sitting in a jail cell trying to get out.
Right. Absolutely. There's definitely a place for, I mean, we are humans. We have our limitations, and machines can do a lot of individual things a lot better than us. So it's just being able to figure out those places and making sure that presumably those judges are not out on the street now. They were reassigned to other cases and things. So, I mean, it's just a matter of being able to incorporate these things into our society.
Yeah. Do we really know everything that Google is up to? I mean, every once in a while, something comes out. Whoa, they're involved in autonomous cars. Whoa, they're involved in artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they're building a spaceship somewhere. I mean, do we really know everything that Alpha is up to?
I guess the conservative scientific answer would be like, probably not. I'm sure that they're doing a few things in secret that they don't want everyone else to know about. But of a lot of the big tech companies, I do feel like Google is more open than they need to be, for sure. And I don't see where a lot of nefarious secret plans have room in their mandate. So while we might not know every single thing they're working on, I do feel like they're probably okay. You know, we don't need to worry about Google right now, however futuristic and sci-fi their ambitions might currently be.
Yeah. You know, I want to talk to you about this other really cool article that you have in the April edition on exoplanets. But before we do, there was something else in the artificial intelligence, and maybe you can help me with it. There's this acronym, ANN, which is Artificial Neural Networks, and it appears to be pretty hot. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, that's kind of what has led to a lot of the recent developments in these super intelligent AIs, even though they're still that narrow, specific intelligence. But basically, these ANNs, the artificial neural networks, are, we say it straight up, they're algorithms or just sets of rules. An algorithm is just kind of do this, then do that, and if this happens, do that. Just very clearly laying out how, in black and white, how to proceed. And the original idea for ANNs were to try and replicate neurons and neural processes in the human brain. And of course, at first, it had to be very crude, and it's just the basic bits of a neuron is either on or off, kind of like a transistor in a computer. It's a one or a zero in the brain. So the ANNs just, they would give them the very crude algorithms and say, if these conditions are met, it's a one. Anything else, it's a zero. And the algorithms would say, okay, sure, and they'd be able to process them, and you'd be able to get a very crude form of basic intelligence from that. If you feed it certain data, then answers would come out. And by tweaking those and making improvements and being able to get modern processing power involved, too, that's another part of the story, is that on paper, a lot of today's ANNs were designed decades ago, but we just didn't have the raw computer power to make it happen. Computers weren't smart enough. They didn't think fast enough in the past to be able to implement these plans, these blueprints of the algorithms. So now that we are at that point, they can put these advanced kind of thinking processes, these thinking instructions in there. And then what's really exciting is when you're able to get to the point where it can feed off itself, and it can produce the you give it an input, you give it a set of data, and then stuff comes out, the output. And then if it can learn from itself, it takes that output, and it goes back in and it kind of refines itself. That's how you get really advanced intelligence. That's how the AlphaGo program was able to get so smart and be able to beat human Go players, just by being able to keep refining itself and improving its own algorithms, its own thought processes.
Yeah, I guess it looked at a whole bunch of different games that had been played, and it just got into this self-learning mode. But
exactly.
For those of you that might be like myself, a little older, you know, I mean, I started in technology in the late 70s, and we had an expression, garbage in, garbage out. And we are the people that are setting the rules for these algorithms and putting the data in. So it's really a function of how well we do in setting these things up in the first place.
Right. I mean, that's what it all comes down to, is who is programming this intelligence. It's still going to be humans. We have to be very careful about what we deem important. If we don't explain to the program that something exists, you know, at the base level, it will not know to look for it. You know, it's very, I mean, we could get into philosophy about it. We could get into morality and what things you should include in artificial intelligence and everything like that. I mean, we don't in the story. That's beyond the scope of the science a little bit. But it quickly gets complicated, and yeah, I mean, it all comes down to humans and what we think is important to to put in intelligence.
Yeah, and just to restate again, Carl Engelking is the author. You were the editor, and it's a really cool article. There's this other article in that issue, and it's by Sarah Scholes. I believe you edited this one as well. It's called World Weary,
right.
The Best is Yet to Come. Call it exoplanet fatigue. Discovery's rolling in every day. Here's why we should still care about finding alien planets. Let's talk about this article.
Oh, sure. I mean, this one, I remember when we kind of came up with this in the office as a joke one day, just because somebody said, Bill, I heard they found new exoplanets the other day. Should we care? Do we need to cover that? Because I'm kind of the resident space guy around here. They came to me as if I am the arbiter. And I said, well, I mean, we should care a little bit, but it's still important. It's, you know, and a lot of kind of hedging. But it's true. I mean, there are so many discoveries that have come out. In the last few years, it seems like there's a new planet that they find out there every month, and that's cool. And if you're into space and if you're into planets, that's amazing. But otherwise, if you're just, you know, going to your job and trying to figure things out, why does it matter? Why should you care, right? Especially because they keep finding them. What's the big deal now? And so that's why we talked to Sarah about this. Sarah's also a huge space fan. She used to work at Astronomy Magazine, which is down the hall from us. So
of course,
she is in the same field as us, and we figured, you know, it is important. It is something that we want to make sure people still see as mattering. And the way that she gets into it is by explaining the context a little bit. I mean, just 25 years ago, exoplanets were still science fiction. Some scientists, actual, you know, legitimate scientists, didn't think we'd ever find any because they might be so rare that the solar system that we're in might be the only planets we ever find. And now 25 years later, we know about some like 4,000 known exoplanets out there, a few of them getting closer and closer to Earth-like conditions. It's rocky, Earth-sized, Earth-like, you know, or our sun is like their star. So getting closer and closer to Earth-like conditions. But, and then here's the other half of why we should care. We still haven't actually found any planet that is really like Earth. And you see Earth-like thrown around a lot, that term Earth-like. And different scientists mean different things when they say it. Sometimes they mean the size of the planet. Sometimes they mean the mass or even like the composition. If it's a rocky planet, then it's kind of Earth-like already. But it still doesn't mean Earth-like when, you know, you're just speaking English and you want to say that thing Earth-like, so there must be trees and oceans on it, right? No, that isn't what they mean. So hopefully in the future, possibly the near future, with the next generation telescopes that are going to be launching soon, we'll be able actually to find really Earth-like planets out there that are like Earth, that have liquid water, that could be conducive to life, maybe, and I don't want to, I want to stress this as a maybe, but that already have life on them. So
yeah.
I mean, that's pretty exciting. I feel like that's why we should still care.
So we're looking at star systems that are very far away, and seeing the difference in the luminosity of these stars, we can tell if there's a planet there, and then we can ascertain how far away it is and what size. Is it a gas? Is it a, you know, whatever? And we just don't understand the biology. So what you're talking about, I believe, is understanding or having the ability to be able to ascertain what the biology of some of these planets are.
Right. I mean, that's kind of the... They say the Holy Grail a lot. Every
right.
scientific field has its own Holy Grail. And this is exoplanet research. Finding a really habitable planet for life as we know it. And hopefully even with actual things inhabiting it. That would be great. And while, yeah, we haven't been able to find anything like that yet, the some of the most famous exoplanets out there with catchy names, like HD209458b, one of my favorites, we can probe its atmosphere a little bit, and they've found that it has traces of water and carbon dioxide and a few other familiar things. But some of the really promising planets are too small or too far away with current technology for us really to be able to look into its atmosphere and see, are there any of the telltale signs of biology that we know about?
Right.
Sarah, in her story, talks about oxygen and ozone with a lack of methane. If we see that in another atmosphere, those are pretty reactive gases by themselves. They would not replenish themselves unless there is life to do so on that world. So if we see stuff like that tells us, yeah, there's probably life forms here, man, that would be pretty great.
So if there's oxygen and there's water and there's not a lot of methane, I think as Sarah points out in the article, that means that photosynthesis is taking place, and that would tell us mm-hmm. that there's some life going on. You know, our first guest this morning, who is named Dr. Andrew Shapiro, he's currently the manager of early stage innovation for the Space Technology Office at JPL. And last Friday, NASA announced the current winners, where they're going to be supporting financially of all these different ideas that came through. And mm-hmm. one of those ideas that's going to move from the idea to the concept, and now it's moving to the project stage, is this gentleman has come up with this idea for a direct multi-pixel imaging and spectroscopy. Of an exoplanet.
Mm-hmm.
with a solar gravity lens mission. So what they're talking about doing is putting a telescope out 600 astronomical units away. That's 600 times the distance between Earth and the sun, so that's pretty far. And it just turns out that the perfect focal point is 600 AU away to be able to use the sun as a lens using photons behind the sun, photons as it hits this lens, to be able to build this telescope to be able to do exactly what you all are talking about in the article, which is to understand the biology of some of these planets.
Yeah, I mean, we're really close to being able to do it. That's one of the most exciting ones. I mean, the whole gravitational lensing stuff is amazing in by itself. Einstein predicted that you should be able to do that because massive objects warp space-time, and so light warps as it goes around it, so all that crazy stuff. Also, I mean, the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope is going to launch next year, we hope, theoretically.
James Webb, yeah, that's
right.
That's going through the testing phase, and that's a big mirror, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it's huge. It makes Hubble look like Spitzer.
yeah,
space telescope jokes. But I mean, everyone's really excited about that. It should be able to do exactly this: look into atmospheres around other planets and analyze them really well. A few other of these major telescopes are going to be going up in the next year or two. So I mean, yeah, we're on the cusp of really being able to find some of these signs of life or other cool features, map out the surface features possibly, see the continents on exoplanets. So a really exciting time that hopefully people haven't been turned off to by all these other discoveries that, oh, another one, sure. Like, no, this is right. This is the best time for it. This is exciting.
Yeah. You know, we had a guy several weeks ago on the program from the Space Telescope Lab in Baltimore, Maryland, and mm-hmm. they have a lot to do with Hubble. And he was saying that even though Hubble is 27 years old, it has been upgraded so many times with the latest and greatest instrumentation packages and lenses and mm-hmm. Refueled for the infrared to be able to cool Hubble the way you need to cool it to be able to sense infrared. It's not an insignificant device. I mean, it's still one heck. It's a rock star of space telescopes.
Oh, absolutely. I've talked to many current scientists, many researchers who got into the field because of Hubble and its amazing views, its data, but also it's just beautiful vistas. It really affects people kind of on an emotional level to be able to see these things and the real beauty of the cosmos. So, I mean, it's a sad in a way that we're going to be kind of replacing Hubble with another telescope, but yeah, it's just such an amazing instrument, and it's still doing really great work. Absolutely.
Bill Andrews, regular contributor to Cool Science Radio and senior associate editor for Discover Magazine. We want to thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you. It's always a fun time. Thank you very much.
Okay, good. We shall return right after these messages. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
We want to thank our sponsors this morning, San Francisco Designs, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Davidson Orthopedics, Nexus IT, and the Natural History Museum of Utah, and of course, Park City. NPR National News is next.